I'm speaking on Philippians because when I put the word out last year saying, what would you like me to speak on? Bevan asked me to speak on a part of Philippians 4. I thought, actually, I don't know anything about Philippians, so maybe we better get there slowly. So we will eventually get to Philippians 4 in about May. Well, we're starting at the start. And I need to preface, as Jenny said, I think we need to name up front that some of us are not that comfortable with Paul. Not this Paul, we like this one. Maybe it's just me, but maybe some of us, others here, are ambivalent or even antagonistic towards Paul. Some of the reasons might be a perception that Paul is overcomplicating Jesus' message and turning it into systematic theology, that at the time people needed Paul, but perhaps we can just go straight to Jesus. That Paul is a moralist harping on about Christian living. Maybe some of us came from a Christian background where you had that thumped over you or felt like you did. I struggle with what feels like Paul's unrealistic optimism and unrealistic life advice, it seems, at times. It seems the writings of Paul have contributed to a strong attitude of buck up and be cheerful and God's doing something good that I find really hard to live with. Perhaps you see Paul as outdated or irrelevant or even offensive. Some of his writings on issues like women, homosexuality, slavery, responding to authority, plurality of religious experience don't read so easily in our culture. Or perhaps you struggle with Paul as damping down the revolution. And I have to say, I hold nearly all these prejudices. It wasn't hard to come up with that list. I've had to wrestle with them. But I also hold that Paul didn't get in there by mistake. And so that's a challenge for me. He clearly was hard to take at the time that he was walking the earth. People struggled with him at that time too. And yet they considered his insights significant enough to pass them on as scripture. And he's the key figure who brought the gospel out of Judaism, for which I owe him my faith, frankly. And however much he is difficult, I'm not a Jew. And if it wasn't for Paul, I may not have been invited into the life of Christ. So on that basis, and some days only on that basis, I owe him at least enough respect to give him a fair hearing. And I'd invite you today to hold that as well. If you're someone who's going to struggle to listen to a whole chunk today, or especially if you've got kids here and that's school holidays and it's hard, if you don't have time for Paul, maybe use this space to just sit with God and your antipathy to Paul and see what bubbles up. Let that be your space today. Or if you love Paul, sit with God and your gratitude to Paul and see what bubbles up in that space. And don't worry about listening to me, that's fine. So an overview of Philippians. Philippi is a Roman colony. It's an agrarian centre. It was established by Octavius, who gave land grants to soldiers leaving the Roman army and settled them there. So it's many of the citizens are ex-military. It's a society with a very strong loyalty to the emperor on account of that and to the empire. There's archaeological evidence that suggests it was a society with a great deal of emphasis on status. There's inscriptions boasting about personal glory very commonly in the archaeology. There was no Jewish synagogue. It was a Greek-speaking community, but it had very strong Roman cultural ethnic links. Interestingly, Macedonia, where it's Philippi's in Macedonia, is one of the places where women had quite prominent roles in society in the Greek and into the Roman period. So it's not that surprising that Paul establishes the church in the home of Lydia, because in that culture, women had roles where that would be not that outstanding. So the Philippian church was established quite early in Paul's journeys into Greece and into the Roman Empire. The original leaders were women. The Philippians then went on to materially support Paul's missionary journeys. Now, Paul in some other places specifically refuses funding from the communities he's with. He will not be a paid speaker. Sorry about that. I am a paid speaker. Some things I don't listen to him on. But he accepted money from the Philippians for him to go and speak somewhere else. So when he was with the Thessalonians, when he was with the Corinthians, he was being funded by the Philippians. They also, the Philippian church contributed very generously to the collection that Paul gathered up to take to Jerusalem for the Christians who were poor in Jerusalem, which was a big deal. He was heading for Jerusalem for what could be a conflict meeting, and he gathered up money to take with to give to the poor in Jerusalem from the Greek church to say, look, the Greeks love you and they're part of the same church. The Philippians, despite the fact that they were poor, gave really generously to that collection. So that's the community we're writing into. So this is a letter. Probably doesn't need to be reset in this community, but it's a letter. And as Peanuts very accurately said, we are reading someone else's mail when we read these books. We need to remember that. Paul is writing to his favourite church. Paul is in prison when he's writing. He's probably in Rome. And the Philippians have sent Epaphroditus to Paul to help him in prison. Roman prisoners were often not really fed properly, so you relied on family and friends to provide what you needed in prison. So despite the fact that it's about 800 miles, I forgot to convert that to kilometres, what's that, 1,200 kilometres between Philippi and Rome, they've sent Epaphroditus with money to be with him in prison and support him. And Epaphroditus has also brought news from Philippi of what's going on, and he's brought news that there's some disunity in the community in Philippi, the Christian community in Philippi. He's also brought news that the Philippians are really worried about Paul in prison. We read that bit from Acts. If one of the key members of the Philippian church is a former jailer in the Roman prison system, you can imagine they might have a pretty accurate perspective on what to be worried about with Paul in prison. There's a possibility they're also concerned that Paul being in prison is hampering the mission, which they're paying for. Now, Epaphroditus got so ill that he nearly died. So Paul and the Philippians have heard about this and they're very worried about their own person now as well. So Paul is sending Epaphroditus home and he writes this letter to accompany him on the way home. It's four chapters. And it follows the conventions of a Greco-Roman letter. And some of the key themes are the overriding importance of proclaiming and living out, proclaiming in your living the gospel of Christ crucified and resurrected, Christ establishing communities of hope and love, humility and service. It's a letter to affirm the special relationship between Paul and the Philippians of friendship and partnership. It's affectionate. And it also has language that's almost contractual. A major theme is to urge upright thinking, to be of the right mind. The very famous chapter 2 about have the mind of Christ, who counted equality with God nothing and emptied himself and came to be a human, is central to this idea of having the right mind, but it runs right through the four chapters. There's another theme about urging unity within the Philippian church. And a strong theme that God is at work, that God's work is good, and despite appearances, God's work is not going to be derailed. Now again, if you're only listening to small bits, this is the only bit, the next bit I'm not going to talk to after that. My invitation is to an imaginative journey. What if Paul was to write to Mount Hawthorne Community Church? If we'd sent someone to him in prison, what news would they have taken of us to report to Paul, and what might he want to say back to us? Whatever I say from here, fade in and out, and anything you hear, just consider how might Paul write out of that context if he was writing to us? And how might we respond? How might I respond? How might you respond to a letter from Paul to our situation? So, today we're going to look at chapter 1. Oh gosh, I've not enough time. All right. So it starts with a standard greeting. The letter is from Paul and Timothy, although Paul is responsible really for the content. Paulus describes himself as a slave of Christ, which is a possessive word. He emphasises he's writing to all the people of the Church of Philippi, which, given there's a disunity, is an important distinction. I'm writing to you all, and I'm not on one side or the other. And then from verse 3 to verse 8, sorry, I need to say there is a pile of Bibles here under the front chair. This is quite content heavy, and I'm not going to repeat all the verses. So if you want to grab one and follow, feel free. I'll assume anyone on their phone is not on Facebook and is following a Bible app. I might test you later just to be sure. Sorry, I should have said that at the start. Pile of Bibles if you want one. So then from verse 3 to 8, there's a section of thanksgiving, which is quite long. It's the longest section of thanksgiving in any of Paul's letters, which indicates his strong sense of love for this community. It establishes the relationship with the Philippians out of which he's writing. It gives his credentials for offering advice, really. And it says, Paul and the Philippians are partners. It's a word used for business partners. We are working together to spread the news of Jesus and expand the community. And it emphasised that Paul loves them. He loves these people. And he believes God is at work in them and through them. Then we've got verse 9 to 11, which is Paul's prayer for the community. He prays that they will increase in knowledge or discernment, the knowledge thing again, which will lead to love increasing. Interesting. Knowledge is not the end in itself. Knowledge is the start. It leads to greater love, which leads to good living, so that when they stand before Jesus eventually, they'll have nothing to be ashamed of. And out of that good living, good things, fruits will overflow, so that everyone will see and will praise God. Everything flows out of the right mind, but that's not the end point. It's interesting to note, standing before Jesus when he judges is also not the end point. It's along the way to the end point, which is so other people will see and praise God. That's the whole point of this Christian living, is so that other people will say, wow, they're onto something. Now the rest of the chapter, the part that Fleur read, could be read as a letter from a missionary writing an update home to his financial backers to ensure that everything's going well, despite things not looking that great. But it's also a letter between concerned friends. Paul is concerned for the Philippians are concerned for him. So the three concerns that Paul is addressing from the Philippians seem to be the concern that Paul is suffering, the concern that the gospel is being hampered by him being in prison. And there seems to be some sort of division in the local church where Paul is, probably the Roman church, caused by him being in prison, and they're worried about that too. So Paul responds to the concern about him suffering, saying, I'm rejoicing. Yes, I know it looks like I'm suffering, but I'm actually rejoicing because the gospel is being spread. And the whole section is overturning the notion that prison equals social shame, equals a poor witness to Christ. And he is rather saying, prison equals an opportunity to show the mind of Christ in my person, equals a fantastic witness to Christ, which completely inverts the cultural understanding of prison and of missionary work in his context. The second concern is the one Paul sees as the most serious, that the gospel may be being hampered by him being in prison. He assures them it's not. He says the whole judicial military establishment is talking about me being in prison and why I'm here. This has been wonderful for getting the word out. It's the no publicity is bad publicity thing. You know, I don't care why they're talking about me, but they're talking about me. That's great. He's also saying the gospel is progressing because local church members, seeing Paul in prison, have got more confident to do the missionary work themselves. Often in a church community, when key people are away for whatever reason, the remainder of the community finds their own gifts come in to fill the gap. And he's rejoicing that that is clearly what's happened in Rome. People have filled the gap of him being out. The third concern is that people are preaching the gospel from bad motives. They're preaching it out of jealousy. What would that mean? Perhaps this is a guess. Perhaps with Paul out of the picture, some people who don't like Paul very much, we are preceded by many hundreds of years of people who don't like Paul very much, starting with the ones who knew him best, thought, brilliant, we can stack the church with our own followers and then we'll have the power. So, given that everyone in the church already, as followers of, came into the church through Paul, how do you stack the church with your own followers? Go and make more converts on your team, and then you'll have a whole lot that can vote for you. Well, not voting, because we're in, Greco-Roman culture. And Paul could see this as the factionalism that it actually is, but he prefers to say, well, that's great. That doubles the numbers in the church. Wonderful. Never mind that they're doing it to get at him. He's not concerned. The content of their preaching seems to be not of a worry to him. If the content had been a problem, Paul would have said so very, very firmly. And then we have some verses from verse 19 to 26 where Paul considers the value of life or death, considers his future. And most commentators think this is a theoretical discussion. Would it be better to die or to live? Because Paul's in prison and he doesn't have control of that outcome. He considers he would really like to be with Jesus. But for the sake of the church, in fact, he says specifically, for the sake of the Philippian church, he will accept with joy if he doesn't die, so that he can encourage them. There's a sense maybe that if he's saved from prison, his saving from prison will be a witness to Christ. But I think it's more that he's saying, every day that I'm living here in this prison, my attitude to living in prison is what is the work of the gospel, is the ongoing speaking and preaching and living this good news. In my suffering, I am embodying Christ, and therefore, in this space, I am teaching and encouraging you. So let's talk a little bit about prison life in the Roman world. Prison life in the Roman world was really, really horrific. There might be up to 50 prisoners crowded together. The prisons were often underground. They were often very dark. There was inadequate food. There was no sanitation. There was no sleeping quarters. Often there was not even anywhere to lie down. There's accounts of people being trampled to death in prison just by the number of other prisoners around them as they get tired. It was particularly bad in the inner prison. Prisons had an inner and an outer, often room. The account we read of Philippi, when Paul and Silas are put in prison, they're specifically put in the inner prison, the worst bit, and then the earthquake releases their chains. They are almost always shackled. Think of those dreadful images from our own history of Aboriginal people shackled together in long lines. This is the life of Roman prisoners all the time. And Paul specifically says, I am in chains, when he's writing this letter. That's not a metaphor. That means he has iron shackles around his leg and another prisoner beside him. There was a deep, deep social shame to being in prison. There is now in our culture too, but my sense of the reading that I did is that it was a deeper and different social shame. People were often held for years. Sometimes they were held for years without charge. Their life was at the whim of the guards, who could be very cruel and often worked entirely on bribery. And even in the moments when things were going okay, perhaps you had someone like Epaphroditus come to bring you food, or you had a guard who you'd managed to bribe or was on good terms with. At any moment, death, torture, torment could strike. So just the nature of prison was a psychological torment and torture. And there were also instances well recorded of physical torture accompanying that imprisonment. There's stories of emperors and officials specifically saying, do not allow that prisoner to die, do not execute them, keep them in prison, because it was a worse punishment to be in prison than to be executed. It is possible that Paul was under house arrest in Rome. If he was, he was almost certainly shackled all the time to a Roman guard. But I think the context of this letter tells us he's in a public prison situation. The Philippians' deep concern, I think, is evidence that he's in a really horrible situation. Again, if they've got a jailer in their midst, they know what it means. the sense of the shame, the deep shame that this is bringing, and the sense that the gospel won't progress in this place, I think that's telling us he's in a public prison. Their sending of Epaphroditus to bring material aid, I think, would not be necessary if he was under house arrest. And Paul's conviction that the whole Roman guard knows about this, I think, tells us that he's in a public situation. He is in one of these horrific prisons. Craig Wunsick, the writer who gave me most of this information about prisons, he suggests that Paul did have a choice between life and death, a real choice. And he's really expressing his decision whether to live or die. Suicide in these Roman prisons was very, very common, particularly because those who were executed by the state lost all their inheritance. Those, if you died in prison but not weren't executed, then your family inherited your estate. So there was a great impetus to knock yourself off before the government could do it, because then your children would have money. The means to suicide was clearly available. But even if that would not be within Paul's moral universe, less actively, it's possible that passive suicide was a possibility. If Paul chose not to defend himself at trial, he knew he would be executed. And this is what Socrates did. But more notably, this is what Jesus did. So Paul has a real choice. Will he defend himself and have a chance of staying alive? Or will he refuse to participate and allow them to kill him? Why tell the Philippians about this internal dilemma? Maybe to encourage them when they feel like quitting, to say, look, I have considered suicide and I see life as more valuable. Maybe to remind them that he's not afraid of death, because it's quite a realistic possibility that the letter they get will actually be one to say Paul's been killed. So to say, no, look, if this is the news you're getting, I long for it, actually. Paul is a man in love with Jesus. It's probably 25 years since he had the experience of the Damascus Road, which may be more than half his life. And he is just longing to be with that Jesus and rest. Slightly more cynically, he may say this to give weight to his advice, because if he says to the Philippians, well, I would quite like to die because it would be much better than this and Jesus would be really great to be with, but I've stayed alive for you. And I've got some suggestions about how you might live now. I think there's a possibility there's some of that in, because Paul does use what you may cynically refer to as emotional blackmail in several of his letters. It's not the only situation. We think of Paul as a travelling missionary, a writer and a church leader. And he did travel, but he spent more time in one place than travelling. He was a writer, but it's probably better to refer to him as a correspondent maintaining long-distance relationships than a writer. We've got no evidence he ever sat down to write his thoughts for posterity. He did establish churches, but he never held a role of a leadership. He was never a regional leader. He was the person who'd helped them come into being. But the thing he was, often and for long periods, was a prisoner. He died a prisoner. Now, this identity was deeply shameful, and he managed to reconstruct it to the highest form of Christian living. And this memory of Paul as a prisoner must have shaped the early church's understanding of him, their decision to hold his letters in high esteem. And it must have shaped his theology and his compassion. So when Paul says, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, which I was taught to learn so that I could tell everyone how sinful they were and how much they needed Jesus, he is speaking as someone who has spent his life alongside people who had completely fallen short of the glory of his society. Not just alongside them, probably leaning up against them. When he says, if I have not love, I am a clanging cymbal. He's not at a wedding. He's writing as someone who has lived in the excrement of prisoners who are shackled to his leg, probably going mad beside him. If I have not love. When he urges moral uprightness, he's writing as someone who's lived years of his life at the whim of corrupt guards, or guards who just by their necessity of life have to depend on breaking the laws to survive. When he says Christ has set us free, he knows what he's talking about in a way that I hope I never know. And what prisoners have most of is time. And he used that time to develop his thoughts about what this Jesus event meant so that he could explain it into the world he was in. The last few verses of the chapter, The last few verses of the chapter, he turns from his own circumstances to the Philippians. And he says he wishes that his life will benefit them, that he's modelling this behaviour and now he's calling them to it. Stand firm, be united, let nothing get in the way of living the gospel. We are in this together. You can learn from my in-prison attitude how to live in your circumstances, and people will see how you live in response to your trials, and they will know you're onto something good. If you argue with each other, they might get the wrong impression. And then he says, you have been granted the privilege of suffering. Well, I'd like to strike that one out. Thank you. The privilege of suffering. He's not talking about suffering in general, although he may have said the same thing about suffering in general. He's talking about suffering as a result of standing up for Christ. Now, again, this is a notion with so much baggage for me of how great it is, a certain pride in people hating you, hating me, because I've been a pain in the behind telling them my good news about Jesus and their sinfulness. I don't think that's what Paul's talking about. He's talking to people within a status-obsessed, emperor-loving, ex-military Philippi who are being punished socially or otherwise for claiming that their Jesus who died as a criminal is the reason for being, who speak about love for all and who model redemption through sacrifice, and who call followers to shed all their airs and be servants of one another. That is what they are suffering for. Why is this a privilege? Maybe it's a kind of opportunity to level up, to have a chance to learn to love better by loving in a harder situation. Paul is not saying that suffering itself is a good thing. I feel like I need to say that 6 times. Paul is not saying that suffering itself is a good thing. But he is saying that how I live in response to my suffering can create a good thing in the midst of a bad thing. That suffering is an opportunity to create a good thing. And my response may become even better because of how terrible the thing is that I'm standing in the middle of. Which leads us on into the next chapter, and that'll be for next time, about having the mind of Christ. So, to pull something together at the end, I think Paul's giving his credentials here about why he has an opinion about the Philippians' practice of faith, and perhaps why he has an opinion about our practice of faith. And these are his credentials as I read them. He is prayerful. He loves these Philippians more than anything. In fact, he says he loves them as much as Jesus loves them. He is totally devoted to preaching, but more importantly, to living the love of Christ. He knows suffering. He really knows it. And he goes on being hopeful and gracious in his darkness. And he passionately wants to help other people live like Jesus. So I think despite my baggage around Paul, that does actually sound like someone that I can respect and learn from. So I end with a question. What might someone so in love with Jesus say to our community or say to me? The question was, has my opinion of Paul changed? I think I've been on a journey of coming to like Paul better. I still don't think I like him, but I respect him. Yeah.
On that I know what you're talking about, and I had an issue with Paul once, and I prayed about it, and the answer came back very clearly. Paul was a man. And it suddenly clicked for me that I didn't have to like him, and he had faults. And just like any person, there are things I wouldn't like about him, and it sort of put him on a different plane to Jesus, because what was really bothering me was people tend to put Paul and Jesus on the same level.
Paul would be outraged for people to put him on the same level of Jesus. He would have been so offended.